Chapter 10 Survival. Have human beings in this bay responded to the same biological imperatives as the animals? Is it possible to see human history here as a branch of natural history, as another dimension of ecology? The spirit hanging behind those questions is the bleak figure of the Reverend Thomas Malthus, the late 18th century clergyman, curate at a small country chapel at Oakwood in Surrey, a few miles from his parents' house in Albury. He arrived there, freshly graduated from maths at Cambridge, in 1789, a rich, tall, 23-year-old who spent his time socialising, walking, riding and shooting. The people in Oakwood were poor and small. The average difference in height between rich and poor in late 18th century England was nearly 9 inches, living in dirt-floored hovels. Malthus described them, "The sons and daughters of peasants will not be found such rosy cherubs in real life as they are described to be in romances. It cannot fail to be remarked by those who live much in the country that the sons of labourers are very apt to be stunted in their growth and are a long while arriving at maturity. Boys that you would guess to be 14 or 15 are, upon inquiry, frequently found to be 18 or 19. Malthus reflected on the causes of these small bodies, and in his Essay on the Principle of Population, published anonymously in 1798, came to the conclusion that the poor were small because they were underfed. They were underfed because there were too many of them, and there were so many of them because the drive to procreate was unstoppable. Lust will always outstrip food supply, and humanity will forever be held between the pincers of hunger and desire, victims of what the French Arnal historian Emmanuel Leroy Ladurée called the Malthusian scissors, the ever-closing blades in which human populations are caught between growing numbers and the inability of the environment to feed them. Malthus had been reading the Marquis de Condorcet, the French rationalist philosopher whose Essay on the Progress of the Human Mind had been published just after his death in 1795. When the increase of the number of men surpasses their means of subsistence, Condorcet had written, the necessary result must be either a continual diminution of happiness and population, or at least a kind of oscillation between good and evil. Condorcet had suggested that this miserable swinging between enough food and too many people would occur only at some time in the future. Malthus understood, from baptizing and burying too many of the shrunken Oakwood poor, that the time of suffering was already with us. He knew that the period when the number of men surpassed their means of subsistence has long since arrived, and that this necessary oscillation, this constantly subsisting cause of periodical misery, has existed ever since we have had any histories of mankind, does exist at present, and will for ever continue to exist unless some decided change takes place in the physical constitution of our nature. It is a grim post-Enlightenment view. The rationalists' dreams of perfectibility and happiness were over. Human misery was the face of necessity. Populations would rise to the level of subsistence and then be cut down by epidemic and famine, leaving more room and more food for the survivors. After famine there would be a time of relative plenty, but the prospect of poverty would always remain. As the population expanded again, the productive capacity of the land, despite the extra labour expended on it, would not be able to keep up. The law of diminishing returns would kick in, and food production per head decline. The poor would starve again. Alongside its apocalyptic companions of war and disease, famine acted as what Malthus called a check on the lives of men, women and children. The fate of human populations in this Malthusian picture can only follow a sawtooth graph in which the natural increase is intermittently but regularly scythed away and cut back to the carrying capacity of the land. famine, sickness, battle, and in many societies infanticide, abortion and emigration were the inevitable responses to the repeated and unending pregnancies and the clamouring mouths of the children that emerged from them. This nightmare was the dark twin of Rousseau's picture of the simple life, a human existence before culture, a radical exposure to nature, no barriers between people and the biological facts of existence, a subjection to the disciplines and opportunities of the natural world. For Rousseau, the inhabitants of modern society had lost touch with that beautiful world of nature and connectedness. Malthus, looking at the poor around him, saw that they had never escaped its control or vigilance. There is something horrible in the acceptance of these conclusions. To decide that there was nothing to be done, that charity, Malthus argued against the poor laws or any taxes or rates intended to support the able poor, was throwing good money after bad, that subsidies only delayed the moment when the food ran out, by when all efforts at kindness had only created a larger population to die. To think like this is a surrender to nature, to assume that humanity can do nothing to lift itself away from the kind of existence experienced by most natural populations. That assumption of a Malthusian necessity was a way of thinking indulged in by the early 19th century advocates of the clearances, including those who lived in this bay. Nevertheless, the facts are there. As the Australian biologist Tom White has straightforwardly set them out, the number of organisms in any habitat is determined by the amount of nutrients available for the primary producers. The greater this is, the greater the biomass in subsequent levels of the food chain. Each depends upon the one below. All are driven by their genes to maximise the number of young produced, and so are constantly pressing hard against the changing limits set by their environment. This is the Malthusian basement. Did it apply to people here? Was pre-modern life here shaped by the Malthusian miseries? Without question, at one level it was. Along with the rest of early modern Europe, life in the pre-modern Scottish Highlands was afflicted and even dominated by frequent but unpredictable mortality crises. Many of these episodes were linked to famine, others to smallpox or the plague. Lack of food caused death rates to increase, especially in young children, largely because in children the competition between the maintenance of physical health and the growth of their bodies is at its fiercest. The stress of malnutrition shuts down the immune response to infection, and it is from infectious diseases that children in a famine usually die. This connection of hunger and disease remains today the leading cause of child death worldwide. In evolutionary terms, this response to stress is among the most ancient of all animal responses, going far beyond mammals, birds, amphibians, and fish, deep into the territory of the invertebrates. Shelley Adamo, a specialist in psychoneuroimmunology at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, has found that stress hormones modify immune function in all mollusks, insects and crustaceans. In these animals, as in the vertebrates, stress usually suppresses the immune system. It may be that evolution has selected the suppression of the immune response in children, allowing them to die during famine, so that adults of breeding age can monopolise the food that remains. Many animal populations that are confronted with hunger abandon their offspring, called brood neglect among ornithologists, since there is a clear advantage in prioritising the survival of adults that can breed again the next year. Sheer difficulty has shaped life here. Morven, like all the ragged fringe of the West Highlands and Islands, is difficult to survive in, difficult to get to, and difficult to communicate within. The land which might have grown crops for people and fodder for animals in a more sheltered and less wet environment was either too high, too acid, too thin, too exposed, or too wet. The annual rainfall in the bay is about 8 feet, a swimming pool's worth across the entire landscape. The growing season is short. In a climate so wet, the Minister of Morven wrote in 1798, it is not to be supposed that sowing can commence early. We commonly begin about the middle of March. Harvest was always threatened by wet or the early arrival of winter. The whole of the parish, especially the west side, or that part which looks towards the Sound of Mull, is so much exposed that the raising of crops is always a precarious business, and, in some seasons, a certain loss. Even now, silage for cattle can be made only in September, 3 months or more after the south of England. The West Highlands as a whole could expect a crop failure once every 3 years. For every grain of black oat sown, the most that could be expected at harvest was 4 or 5 in return, of which 1 had to be kept as seed corn for the following year. Barley did better if sown on ground manured with sheep dung, a 7-fold return. If sown on ground manured with seaweed, that could double again. But to manure many acres by hand was ruinous and exhausting work. Most of the arable area never received any manure, but was used for a season or two until its naturally occurring nutrients were exhausted, and then left for a decade or more to recover. No generation would pass without a famine. They appear as soon as anybody thought to record them, in 1680, 1688, the 1690s, 1740, 1751, 1756. These, according to Eric Richards, the Australian historian of the Highlands, only the most publicised. Even after the great changes of the 18th century and the acceptance of the potato as a staple, famine returned. The winter, spring, summer and autumn of 1782 to 1783 were particularly painful. Rain and cold throughout 1782, a bitter December, January and February, a late spring and then excessive rain at harvest, followed again by an early and severe winter. Potatoes and cereals were both destroyed. Hundreds of people were found dead lying by the roads, in caverns and amongst thickets where they had taken shelter. Starvation, near starvation, and the prevalence of destitution returned to the West Highlands in 1806 to 1807, 1811, 1816 to 1817, 1837 to 1838, the mid-1840s, and the 6 terrible years of 1847 to 1853. It would have been no different in all the unrecorded centuries, and these are the foundational realities, the Malthusian assaults on people's lives. As soon as visitors from the south came to see what life was like in the Highlands, the poverty horrified them. Among the earliest was Edmund Burt, an English government administrator appointed to oversee the estates confiscated after the Jacobite Rebellion in 1715. He wrote a series of letters in the late 1720s to a friend in London. At a winter fair, Burt told him, if you could conceive rightly of it, you must imagine you see 200 or 300 half-naked, half-starved creatures of both sexes, without so much as a smile or any cheerfulness among them, stalking about with goods up to their ankles in dirt, and at night numbers of them lying together in stables or other outhouse hovels that are hardly any defence against the weather. The Highland gentry were well fed, but the poor were haggard. You would hardly think by their faces they were of the same species. Burt concluded, accurately enough, that the poor had been starved when in the womb and had never recovered. Here is a melancholy appearance of objects in the streets. In one part the poor women, maidservants and children, in the coldest weather, in the dirt or in snow, either walking or standing to talk with one another, without stockings or shoes. When travelling out into the country, Burt became the manager of the lead mines at Strontian, just north of Morven. He found a landscape of poverty as distressing as the sight of the people themselves. In the townships, dwellings and barns and stables were all irregularly placed, some one way, some another, and at any distance looked like so many heaps of dirt. Robert Southey later called these houses man-sties. Burt saw children come out from the huts early in the morning stark naked and squat themselves down, if I may decently use the comparison, like dogs on a dunghill. Inside the huts he found people chronically liable to fluxes, fevers, agues, coughs, rheumatisms and other distempers. In the windowless dark, they sit brooding in the smoke over the fire till their legs and thighs are scorched. The long continuance in the smoke makes them almost as black as chimney sweeps. Thomas Pennant, on Isla in 1774, found a set of people worn down to poverty, their habitations scenes of misery. They were left to Providence's care, he wrote. They prowl like other animals along the shore to pick up limpets and other shellfish. Numbers unknown in all parts of the Western Highlands fall beneath the pressure, some of hunger, more of the putrid fever, the epidemic of the coasts, originating from an unwholesome food, the dire effects of necessity. The spring, when the grain derived from the harvest the year before had run out, was known as the starving season. The shellfish could add a little to the diet, and the proverbial wisdom of the Gallic world was full of reflections drawn from that bitter harvest. There may have been plenty of them. Is lum an jechig nach tiener nach eier murig? It's a bare stone where no shellfish are to be found. But it was a small consolation that Ishtia rech nuar evisia hura cool vi emurech ravar. In spring, when the sheep is lean, shellfish are fat. You must take your chances. Rinia emurech ad ze van trai aun. You must gather shellfish when the tide is out, and only attention would allow you to survive. Chiadian cas lua murech, a hasty foot, won't get you shellfish. In these ways, the austerity of the environment, the paucity of its gifts, and the scratching of a living from a hostile world all played their part in shaping the mentality of a people. The scale was pitiable. The half-starved horses were little bigger than asses. Their carts were the size of wheelbarrows. The goats' kids would sell in the 1720s for no more than sixpence or eightpence apiece, the price of 3 or 4 hours' work by a labourer. The spoons they used were made of horn or wood, their platters of wood. One boy, when asked in the 19th century by the minister of Morven what he ate for breakfast, answered, "Potatoes." And for dinner, "Potatoes." For supper, "Potatoes." "Do you have nothing else?" The boy thought for a moment. "Yes, a spoon." Everywhere Bert looked, he saw people squeezing the resources on which they relied. "I do not remember to have seen the least spot," he told his London friend, "that would bear corn uncultivated, not even upon the sides of the hills, where it could be no otherwise broke up than with a spade." The desperate shortage was of fertility. Not far from Fort William, I have seen women with a little horse dung brought upon their backs, in creels or baskets, from that garrison, and on their knees, spreading it with their hands upon the land, and even breaking the balls that every part of the little spot might have its due proportion. Here, at least, the seaweed could add a little to enhance the carrying capacity of the land. The sea ware, when it was harvested in May, was draped over stone field walls and left there to dry. All along the Atlantic seaboard, the gathering was women's work, heavy and wet as they brought it up from the foreshore in creels on their backs. Tim Robinson heard the story of a farmer in Arran on the west coast of Ireland looking for a wife. Whatever his other ideals of beauty, modesty and gentleness, the farmer would never consider a girl who would not carry a good burden. Is e moluch ne mna oigye e druim vehi fluch. Praise of the young woman that her back be wet. Wet, that is, with the brine from a basket of weed. The dried seaware was taken to the growing grounds above the beach, and applied heavily before the oats or barley, or increasingly after 1760, potatoes were sown in the enriched soil. The average needed for each crop was about 160 creels an acre, perhaps 2.5 tons when the weed was wet. In a place where the natural fertility was so low, the seaweed was a good fertilizer, with as much nitrogen and twice the potash of farmyard dung, even if its effects did not last as long. Across the centuries of subsistence agriculture here, about an acre of cultivated ground was needed for each person. A family of five would, in an ideal world, have 800 creels of this seaware, or about 12 tons wet weight, carried up and onto its arable grounds. It was goodness to be derived from the sea, but only with unending labour and physical exertion. Exhausted hunger lurked in the margins of this life. Only one or two generations beyond living memory, there was famine here. Donald Morrison, then in Mull, interviewed in 1974, remembered as if it were his own experience the terrible time in the 1840s, when his father was alive in Morven and, as Donald said with an indraw of breath, the people were eating the shellfish then. The old, carefully chiselled and close-set stone pier giving on to the narrows of the mouth of the loch was built as relief work in that horrendous decade for 31 Morven families who were starving after the potato crop had failed. The men, women and children who built the pier received food, oatmeal and wheatmeal, instead of money for their work, part of the Victorian understanding that charity in return for nothing rotted the moral substance of its recipients. The usual allowance for a man was 1 shilling's worth of meal a day. Women were given £5 a meal a week, and children more or less according to their age. Without it, they would have died. Norman MacLeod, minister of this parish, described the dignity and spiritual grandeur of those coming in dire hunger to receive charity. The old people suffered deeply ere they accepted any help. I have known families who closed the windows to keep out the light, that their children might sleep on as if it were night, and not rise to find a home without food. I remember being present at the first distribution of meal in a distant part of the Highlands. Their clothes were rags, but every rag was washed and patched together as best might be. Yet during all these sad destitution times, there was not a policeman or soldier in those districts. No food riot ever took place, no robbery was attempted, no sheep was ever stolen from the hills. And all this though hundreds had only shellfish or dulse gathered on the seashore to live upon. Human existence here was on the boundaries of the viable, and that poverty generated community. As archaeology and the earliest maps reveal, human settlement was crammed into every niche where life was possible. The large-scale maps of the Military Survey of Scotland made after the Jacobite Rebellion of 1745 to 1746, a series known to its contemporaries as the Great Map, and now named after its chief surveyor, William Roy, are speckled with the tiny settlements of the people. Little clusters of red buildings pimple the level, sheltered places, the names usually misspelt by the non-Gaelic-speaking surveyors. Each gathering of houses is surrounded by its sketched-in arable fields, with the hills and rocks and rivers of the difficult country above them washed in as though for a watercolour view. Paul Sandby, later famous for his views of Windsor Castle, was the artist employed by the survey. It is the most poignant map of Scotland, a hostile military authority delineating with such confidence and elegance a world of poverty, suffering and subjection. Nearly all of the small places the Roy map shows are ruined and abandoned now. The main settlement here, high above the bay on a saddle of land between the Sound of Mull and Loch Allen, is painted in and named Ard Tornish by the military surveyors, surrounded by the stipple of its arable fields, but is now entirely gone. The modern maps still mark above it the Achag na Cruiv Sciag, the field of the hawthorn tree, but the site of the township itself is a forgotten place, where any remains of buildings are unseen in a flood of bracken and gorse. The village was tucked into a hollow, invisible from the sea in all directions and hidden from the wind. You would have felt safe there, the old tracks to the loch on one side and to the bay on the sound on the other are still there, used by James Shanks, the shepherd, on his all-terrain vehicle, and their surfaces are worn down to the underlying plates of basalt. The grass beside them is thick with the little yellow stars of Tormentil. Rowan trees flower in springtime next to the old village, and a lovely small burn, its water the colour of the back of a dark trout, runs through the settlement, and down to Midir Bay on Loch Allin. There was another settlement below this one called Nether Ard Tornish, perhaps on the site of the Victorian house where the Shankses now live, overlooking the fields on which the sheep and cattle now graze. People were folded into the place. The place itself was a map of their lives and their connections, held not directly from the chief of the clan, but from his chief tenant or taxman, and arranged in a ring structure, at the centre houses and barns, with kale yards or vegetable gardens beside them. Beyond that, the regularly cultivated infield, then the rarely cultivated outfield, then the rough hill grazing, in which all members of the township had common rights. Up there, too, were the shealings, where the women and children took the animals for the summer weeks and made cheeses. Until the mid-18th century, when the Duke of Argyll, whose land this was, insisted they should be made of stone, their houses were built of wood from the surrounding country, from the materials that still grow here, the inner walls made of woven hazel hurdles, wattled like a basket, connected to heavy crooks or couples on a dry stone foundation. The slight sea and wind-twisted Morven oaks provided the curving timbers. Turf walls were laid around the outside, each turf laid grass to grass, earth to earth, and the walls bound together by the growing grass roots. The houses were models of energy-conscious coherence. The peat smoke from the central hearth filled the house's roof and worked as a fungicide to preserve the timbers. Meat and fish could be cured up there, and the never-absent fire created what the ethnographer Alexander Fenton has described as a smoky shimmer of heat, the essence of homeliness for generations of Highlanders, within which, on long evenings, people would gather for storytelling and gossip. The thatch was replaced every 10 years, and the entire roof, enriched by its years of soot, could profitably be spread on the fields. The third element in this system, connected to poverty and communality, was a ferocious reliance on hierarchy. The internal discipline of the clan and group violence directed towards others, clan warfare, was an integral part of this life. It was not an egalitarian world, but highly stratified, with 6 or 7 levels in it. Chief, taxmen, joint tenants, cotters, landless labourers, the weak and indigent. In pre-modern centuries, punishment was in the hands of the clan chief, and as the Morven minister in 1843 reported, in the face of the rock overhanging the Bay of Ard Tornish, is pointed out the precipice over which the transgressors of feudal laws were thrown. On the small piece of flat land above the cliff, it was said to a traveller in 1800, the clan chief held his court, and if the prisoner was found guilty, the place of execution was to hand. The clan was an insurance system, a straightforward response to shortage, and the likelihood that the land, every few years, would fail to feed the people. The chief exacted rent, held reserves, or organised the stealing of them from others, and in that way looked after the people who depended on him. His own castle was accompanied by a gurnal house, in which goods and food could be stored, with a drying kiln for the grain beside it. In times of plenty, the chief accumulated food. In times of dearth, he distributed it. The castle on the headland that closes the bay to the west is a ruin now, a rather rough grey stone box on the summit of a mound that overlooks the point. In the Middle Ages, it was not especially defended. What remains is only the basement, with grassed-over rubble filling most of it. When in use, a stair within the walls led to a single upper chamber that probably had large and magnificent windows looking out onto the Sound. This belonged to the MacDonalds, Lords of the Isles, and they used it as a place for gathering and feasting, surveying the apron of sea around it, with a good anchorage in the bay in its lee, away from the westerlies, and yet visible as a tall silhouette for 10 miles in each direction up and down the Sound. No one sailing the length of this waterway could fail to recognise its lordliness and near-regal position on its headland. The MacDonalds were no insignificant parochial chieflets. They could command forces in their thousands, numerically at least, far more than any bodies of armed men raised by English royal dukes for the invasions of France in 1415 and 1475. In the summer of 1461, they conducted wild sea-reaving raids on Arran and Bute to the south and across the north of Scotland to Orkney, descending that June in great numbers with their fleets and ships in warlike manner to the said earldom of Orkney, and burned the lands, villages, houses and buildings to the ground, and most cruelly suppressed the people of both sexes and of all ages with the sword, and cruelly carried away with them their goods, animals, household stocks, jewels, money and everything they could for their own use, leaving little or nothing except the burnt soil of the ground, empty and useless. This enormous and violent energy of clansmen on a raid can be seen in a Malthusian light. The clan was itself an instrument of survival, an essentially warlike structure of chief, taxmen and subtenants. The women did most of the farming, the men the fighting and cattle raiding. The clan's lifeblood was in raiding, stealing food in the form of cattle and destroying the lives of rivals by burning their crops was an integral part of the system. Feuding, loyalty, punishment for disloyalty, feasting, the summoning to war, the use of violence as a habitual and even theatrical tool of community cohesion, all were part of an ecology whose essential condition was the poverty of the land. All men naturally hate each other, Blaise Pascal said, and here, as in other societies threatened by hunger, the possibility of hatred was always in the air. A clan, united by real or fictional blood ties, was a means of controlling that potential for mutual destruction and channeling the aggression away from neighbours towards more distant others. Clan raiding prevented neighbourhood anarchy. War with others created local community. Only with loyalty to the chief, a loyalty itself imposed by the threat of violent punishment, could those local rivalries, driven by competition for resources, be diffused. What is lost in the historical documents that describe this three-part structure of poverty, communality, and outward-directed violence is the other and most precious dimension of this world. A sense among the people who lived here that their lives were founded on a rich and subtle amalgam that fused elements of their own families, their songs, the place in which they lived, their right to be here, the sea and land on which they depended for their well-being, the presence of the past and their telling of the stories that came down to them from it. Gaelic has no term equivalent to landscape, that purely visual painter-come-surveyor's word used to describe a place. Instead, there is something richer folded into the one complex idea of duchess. It can mean a hereditary claim, anything that is a birthright, an ancestral estate, a patrimony. Duchess can be the tradition or custom by which something is made legitimate. Duchess is how it has always been done, but it can also mean a person's native place or country, their ancestral home, full of their traditional connections. A man who leaves for the south has forsaken his duchess, he is no longer at home, and if he returns to his duchess, He has gone back to where he belongs, and metaphorically become himself again. He is in his old haunts, once again, as he always was. Duchis describes a world of natural affinities and connectedness, where people are surrounded by things of their own kind. It represents a psychic home, where, through heredity, everyone shares innate qualities and a natural bent. Duchis is an aptitude and inclination. It is how you naturally are. You can be musical by Duchis, or a good seaman, or it can be used of a cow that is of a good milking strain. According to a proverb, Duchis is stronger than any upbringing. Duchis is the gathering of your instincts, but it is also your native place, your habitat, and how you think. It is both homeland and innermost being, your right to what is yours. It is what you inevitably are. If in the hierarchical structure of a clan there are echoes of prawn life, in Duchis there are suggestions of a kind of clonal arrangement like the anemones. Duchis is what the English words tradition and place and heritage all try to say. The dependence of pre-modern human life here on the products of the land and the need to resist the exigencies of the environment mean that self, family, world, survival, memory and song are moulded to each other more intimately than could be imagined in a modern commercial and urbanised world. Community, the woven thing, is one of the foundations of life on Earth. Seabirds live like this, many of them exploring the widths of the Atlantic Ocean each winter, but profoundly tied to where they were born, most of them returning for many decades to breed in the place they undoubtedly know as home, more often than not nesting near where their parents had raised them, surrounded by their cousins, siblings, uncles and grandchildren, deeply familiar with every nick and wrinkle of their homeland. It may be that Duchis is also a natural phenomenon, undescribed because we cannot learn or know the languages in which it is known. It is not easy to recover the actual living reality of that fusion of memory, daily life, places and story, but there is no doubt it was alive here. The combination of extreme privation and a rich culture is by no means unusual in peasant societies. Eric Richards, the historian of the Highlands, has said, but not until the coming of the tape recorder was it possible for outsiders to catch the ways in which Duchis played out in people's minds. Sawley MacLean, the greatest of all modern Gaelic poets, who in 1938 experienced one of the fulcrum years of his life as a teacher in Tobermory across the Sound, made a series of tape recordings in Edinburgh in 1982, in which he provided an extraordinary window into this world, spinning out a picture of his life in which genealogy, inheritance, song, place, culture, pride, love, energy, and vivid being were sewn into the one treasured fabric of existence. He was prepared to go a certain distance towards the horizon, but not prepared to leave the landscapes and seascapes where the navigation markers of his spirit were located. His admirer, Seamus Heaney, said in Edinburgh in 2002, Heaney spoke of MacLean's highly cultivated genealogical awareness and of his speech which came to Heaney with the force of revelation, the mesmeric, heightened tone, the weathered voice coming in close from a far place, the surrender to the otherness of the poem, above all, a sense of bardic dignity and calling that was without self-parade and was instead the effect of a proud self-abnegation, as much a submission to heritage as a laying claim to it. A sense of bardic dignity, the weathered voice coming in close from a far place. Those are the sounds of Duchis, as it was heard here for generation after generation, within the walls of the houses where now there are only moss and crane's bills, absence and silence. Well, I am soel ye mach chalim, ich chalim, ich ein, ich harmad, ich ein, ich harmad. Sawley, son of Malcolm, son of Malcolm, son of Ian, son of Norman, son of Ian, son of Norman. That's as far back as we can go with certainty. Now the MacLeans. My father was a very fine singer, and he was a very fine piper. My brother, Shawnee, used to say that he could recognize his father's playing anywhere, and my uncle Alistair was a piper too, and my father was a very good singer. And my grandmother, my father's mother. She was Marie Matheson, and she was a very fine singer. In my early memories, she used to sing splendid old songs. Oh, what didn't she sing? Wherever she went to live, she learned new songs. She had a splendid memory. She was confined to bed for the past 4 years of her life, but that didn't stop her singing. And they say she was very good-looking herself. It seems that her nickname was Sugar Ian Ichemish. Ian Ichemish's Sugar. She was full of old songs. I can't forget them somehow. My father's sister, Peggy, we had to go out fishing with her, and it's all songs. She was full of old songs. I used to threaten to go on strike unless she sang songs. My father's sister, Flory, was good at the songs too. Peggy had things that her mother didn't have. I think it may have been from her father they got it, for he was a sort of bard, my grandfather, Callum MacLean. My grandfather was Soelie Iain ich Soelie Fiberie. He was a piper in Spain and got his hands damaged. The frost got him and his fingers stiffened, and he came out of the army. He was at the Battle of Corunna in January 1809, and it was in the retreat to Corunna that that happened to him. The thing was, I couldn't sing as most of my people could, so I got tremendously keen about a lot of the old Gaelic songs. And so, though I couldn't get the pitch right, it used to drive spears through me almost, the rhythm, the movement and the time, when I heard something I thought was wrong. I grew up at that time when symbolism was such a thing in European poetry, and I was affected a lot by Hugh McDermott and Yeats, and my symbols almost automatically became the landscape of my physical environment. But of course, that was always affected, blended with what I knew of the history of my people. Hear that voice, and you can hear the voices of those who once lived in this bay and are now gone. What is the answer to the question? Is human history here a branch of natural history? Is our own story merely another dimension of its ecology? In part it is. We suffer and struggle like the other animals, fight and dominate, threaten and display, make alliances, establish our hierarchies and exploit the weak like all the others. But we are different in this. We are the storytelling, past-remembering, culture-making animals. It is that which distinguishes us and which means that Malthus can never have the last word. In 1940, in despair at his disappointments in love, his fear that courage had failed him in not going to fight the fascists in Spain, and grief over the destruction of the Gaelic world he had witnessed in Mull, Sawley MacLean felt his life running to the seas, through heather, bracken and bad grass, on its fanked, eerie course, like the mean and shallow stream that was taking its meagre way through a green patch to the sea in the Kyle. In part, he felt as much a victim of circumstances as any creature, but there was more. He knew he could hope for resilience. Every ebb implied a flood. Again and again a spring tide came, to put beauty on the river foot, to fill its destination with richness, and sea-trout and white-bellied salmon came to taste the water of the high hills with flood-tide in Inver Eyre. Maveha rihi hun nan quanten, tro ruch is ranyek is droch irech, ir ecursi fangte tievi, mar en struhan, stunie suerech, vagachal schlie chrin tro chluaneg, gekuan auns e chul, Ach ur is ur, hied, ruerst, echur drech ir bunne heine. E lienech, e kjoin uiele saivris. Is hied, gialag is braden, tar jal. E vlascheg, uschkie nan ard vjaun, rilan en inir aiere.